Lotus, the complete story. I've been looking forward to this all day. From the Mark 1 in 1948 to the world's most powerful electric hypercar in 2021, the story of Lotus encompasses ongoing technical innovation on road and track. 74 F1 Grand Prix wins, 6 drivers and 7 constructors F1 World Championships over 7 hectic decades. Some of the world's most stylish and desirable sports cars and grand tours. It's all in this new book called Lotus, the Complete Story by Johnny Tipler. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, Johnny himself. Johnny, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Thanks a lot for having me on.
The pleasure is all mine. Lotus, it's a name. It is the DNA of Lotus is inbred with motorsport, and it all sort of comes down to one genius, doesn't it?
Yes, and that was Colin Chapman, who created his first car out of basically an Austin 7. In his girlfriend's parents' garage in 1948. It grew through a succession of specials. He started building kind of meaningful race cars, the Type 11, in the mid-50s, and that they looked more like spaceships than what racing cars had looked like up until that point.
And I mean, up until that point, say in the mid-50s, I mean, Chapman was very much what Enzo Ferrari termed as, what was it, garagistas, wasn't he? That brand of English designers making these cars in their garages, basically.
Well, he was. He started off, as I say, in his girlfriend's parents' garage, and then he moved into the stables behind his dad's pub in Tottenham. And not until 1960 did the whole enterprise, which was a going concern by then with the elite and the Type 18 Formula One car. They moved out to Chessington in Hertfordshire. Where projects like the Lotus Cortina evolved out of that, and as I don't need to tell you, the Jim Clark and the winning the F1 World Championship in 63 and then 65, plus the Indianapolis 500, sort of shaking up the whole.
Which is absolutely, absolutely legendary. A little bit then about, because there were so many people, it was after the war, it was after sort of austerity, and people, I mean, a lot of sort of racing drivers, designers were, you know, testing out their innovation and their theories on the track. And for Lotus and for Colin, it was always lightweight, wasn't it? He saw, you know, saving the I was going to say the kilos or the pounds as an intrinsic part of his philosophy for both racing and road going cars.
That's right. I mean, the cliche is that he said, add lightness, and that is still a Lotus sort of go-to expression today. The lighter the construction and the more aerodynamic, then the smaller the engine you needed to make it go quickly.
And it's interesting as well, isn't it? Because if you think about when Lotus started entering cars in the sports world, you know, the big players from the UK side were Aston Martin and Jaguar. And when Chapman took it into Formula One, I mean, they didn't do, if you like, F1, and the lightness of his cars and his philosophy was absolutely perfect for things like the Lotus sort of 63, which, you know, Clark raced with such success.
Yeah, absolutely. And that innovative streak, it takes you into a succession of evolutions. I mean, the Type 25, which Clark won the world championship with, was the first all-aluminium monocoque. And then he goes to the Type 49 Formula One car in 67. Which incorporates the engine as part of the chassis, and so on. Then you get the wedge shape Type 72, all of these sort of steal the show, and they're ahead of the opposition. And then we can jump to 1978, and the ground effect cars, the Type 78 and 79, with which Mario Andretti won the World Championship. This was where you harness the air flowing around the racing car so that it goes through Venturi underneath the car in the side pods and sucks it to the track. And the faster you go, the harder it is sucked onto the track. And that's why Andretti and Peterson just took the 78 championship by storm.
Absolutely. If you look at the way that, you know, Chapman, he looked at the rule book and then sort of thought, what can I get away with, basically? And also in that 60s period, there were so many great teams coming out. You know, we had Jack Brabham, you know, starting his own team. We had McLaren starting their own team. There were lots of developments. But, you know, Chapman with the wings, Chapman with the four-wheel drive, you know, the wedge shape, of course, that he introduced, putting the AirPods at the side, which was in the Lotus that, you know, Rindt won his championship with, you know, with so far ahead of what anybody else was doing.
Yeah. We can throw in the gas turbine as well, which was a helicopter engine. Which ought to have done well, but I think the tyres weren't up to it. That's why that didn't make it, really. Those lofty wings on the Type 49, that where the struts, it was so tall, the wing, that although the driver could feather the wing coming into a corner, he'd dip the wing so that it put more pressure on the back of the car to give it better downforce around the corner. But the struts were just, I mean, it was an experiment. They were too tall, and there were some really nasty accidents.
Well, famously, of course, the Spanish Grand Prix when Hill and Jochen crashed within inches of each other.
Absolutely. And that put the mockers on that particular design, and they were banned. And so rear wings from that point were attached to the back of the chassis.
At the same time, of course, you know, you mentioned the Lotus Cortina, which was driven to great effect by Jim Clark. There are, if you go online, you will see pictures of him on three wheels, basically going around every corner. How was the actual road car program going? Because we had some, again, the 60s and the 70s. I mean, Lotus was a Bond car, for goodness sake, at one point.
Well, the Esprit was certainly featured in a couple of Bond films. The elite from the late 50s, 57, was that was revolutionary in its own right. It was entirely a fiberglass body and a fiberglass chassis. And nobody had done that at that point. That overlapped with the 7, of course, which is the kit car, which you can still get today as a Caterham. So that was the sort of DIY aspect, and cars like those were built really to fund the racing. I mean, like Ferrari made his road cars to pay for his Grand Prix racing. So did Chapman back then. So we had the Elan, which was the wonderful little Avengers sports car of the mid 60s. And it wasn't really until the early 70s that Chapman thought, right, well, we're going to turn up the wick a bit, and we're going to go upmarket, and we'll have cars like it was the Europa, the mid-engined sports car, you know, car for Europe, sort of thing. But with the Esprit, the Clat. They took it up market.
And of course, at the same time, in the F1, in the 70s, you have perhaps the most distinctive and the most beautiful pairing, because Lotus had been sponsored by Goldleaf. Horrendous that, you know, sponsorship should be brought into F1. Another thing that, you know, Colin was at the forefront of doing, but Goldleaf pulled out and John Player Special came in, and the black and gold JPS raced through most of the 70s. You know, Emerson Fittipaldi won his championship, of course, in that. Ronnie Peterson raced that, and it continued through the 70s. Beautiful cars.
Yeah, it was pretty radical thing to bring in, well, not necessarily tobacco sponsorship, but big time commercial sponsorship, which up until 1968, the teams just relied on a bit of dosh from the petrol companies, the tyre companies, and the brake pads, and so on. Then in comes the floodgates open. In comes the tobacco companies, Players and Marlboro, and Chapman was instrumental in bringing that into Formula One, bringing a lot more money into the sport. So that was quite radical. And as you say, Gold Leaf evolves into JPS in 72. And that John Player Special, Black and Gold, go all the way through to 87. It was a slight glitch where you get Essex petroleum sponsorship in 80 and then Martini in 81. But then for the rest of it, it's Black and Gold up to 87. So by then, of course, Chapman has unfortunately died, but the thing carries on. And latterly, from 87 to 94, you've got Camel, the yellow car.
What was Chapman's relationship like with his drivers, particularly Jim Clark? Because they formed in the early 60s, through to Clark's death in April 68. I mean, that was a partnership of minds, wasn't it? I mean, he was obviously Chapman's favourite driver.
Yes, there was an intuitive sort of bond between them. Clark was just a supreme natural, and Chapman, whatever Chapman gave him to drive, he could win with it. And that wasn't necessarily the case after Clark died. And Graham Hill, the great, he would make lots of notes after each practice session, and the mechanics would have to try everything, every permutation. Whereas Clark would have just got on and driven it. And then you had guys like Jochen Rindt, who was sort of a bit of a law unto himself.
But it was. I mean, it was very interesting. I mean, the drivers he had. I mean, after Rindt being killed in practice at Monza, and then is it true that Ken Miles said, "I'm not going out in one of your cars again"? Is that a bit of a sort of motor racing myth? Because they were light, and accidents did happen. And I know motor racing was very dangerous in those days, but in Lotuses they tended to be almost more dangerous.
Well, you're absolutely right. Rindt's co-driver John Miles, he was actually sacked, but because he refused to drive the car, and quite rightly, because it was one of the reasons why Rindt crashed fatally. But Miles came back as a handling consultant, even working on cars like the Elise.
Chapman passed away, 82, was it? Or was a bit later than that, 82, 84?
82, yeah, he was. People think that. I mean, he had a heart attack, and because he was just going, 100% the whole time. That was how he lived.
And how did the company continue, and how did it rebuild itself? Because we talk about the 80s. I mean, the 80s, I remember Mansell racing with Lotus. We had Senna was racing for Lotus, of course, got his first victory of a long and distinguished career. And as we said, the Lotus name in F1 continued for many years afterwards. And obviously the car program continued as well.
Well, after Chapman died, they were in dire straits. The managing director, Mike Kimberley, who very kindly wrote a foreword to this book, he was elevated to CEO. He got basically Toyota to fund the company, so it didn't go under. So for 2 years, until General Motors took it over, it was fundamentally Toyota money that kept it afloat. And that rapport with Toyota, of course, continues to the present day, or at least since 2000, when the Elise and then the Evora started using the Toyota engines.
Do you think Chapman would recognise the company if he came back today and walked around? Is there still that innovation, or has it gone the route of so many so many brands, and it's become so corporate, so set in its ways? I mean, I'm just thinking of other British car manufacturers who have gone completely, like TVR, for example. So in many ways, we've got to be thankful that Lotus is still there and still, if you like, pushing the envelope a little bit.
Yes, very much so. And of course, the main shareholder, the main owner now is Geely, the Chinese company. And you have to reckon that's a good thing. It's still there. Going back a little bit, after General Motors, you have Proton comes on, so the Malaysian first got control. Now, you said would Chapman still recognise it? But a car like the Elise is very much fundamental to Chapman's original idea. It's a lightweight car with a revolutionary extruded aluminium chassis. And a supercharged 1.8 Toyota engine. It's a great little car, and I'm quite friendly with Clive Chapman, who runs Classic Team Lotus, and of course they spend their time restoring this legacy of famous Formula One cars from the good old days. And he thinks that his father would be proud of what Lotus is producing now.
And that's one of the great things, isn't it? If you go to a classic race meet, like the Goodwood Revival, you will see so many Lotuses, lightweight sports cars, the F1 cars, and they're still out there. Historic racing has now, in the past sort of 30 years, has become a massive thing. When it used to be a few chaps poaching around in their spare time. So, the history of British motorsport is entwined in its DNA with the history of Lotus.
Yes, you say something like the Goodwood Revival. Those events are so much more exciting than modern Formula One. They're really competitive, and the Lotus 25 is a perennial winner at those sort of events. Andy Middlehurst drives what was Jim Clark's car, and it's still a winning car.
So when it comes to putting a book like this together, I mean, where do you start? I mean, how do you put it all in, if you like, a coherent timeline? Because it's such a fascinating story, and there are so many aspects to it.
Well, you're absolutely right. You start with a timeline from 1948 through to the present day, and you identify everything that's happened year by year, and how many units they made of a particular race car, which in case of the racing cars, only three or four units, and a road car, maybe a few thousand. So that's how that stacks up. And then you go from model to model, you research it and talk to people that have them and rebuilt them. A few interviews, like with John Miles now, Jackie Oliver, who was a Formula One racer, Sterling Moss is in there, I think. So yeah.
And of course, you have the images. I mean, some of the pictures are absolutely beautiful, both the classic ones and the more modern ones, the photographs that were commissioned for the book.
I tend to go to events like the Goodwood Revival, the Spa 6 Hours, or Le Mans Classic, the Nürburgring, the old timer, where you see classic Lotus in action on track. And so a lot of the pictures are from those events. The Lotus press office has always been very good about lending these cars to sort of be Glofin and have a road trip. So Yeah.
If you have to pick one race car, here's your start for 10, Johnny. One race car and one road car. What Lotus are we picking? I'm going for the Lotus 49 because of, you know, putting the Cosworth in the back and it being absolutely beautiful. What are you going? That's my race car. What would you pick as a race car and as a road car?
Yeah, the Type 72, which is started off as a gold leaf livery car, and then for most of its life it was a black and gold John Player Special. And of course you've got Emerson Fittipaldi and Ronnie Peterson and Jackie Itt for the main protagonists in the Type 72. For a road car, modern cars are so blooming efficient. I'd have an Evora. It wouldn't matter whether it was a launch model from 2009 or the latest one. The Evora is a brilliant GT car, really. It's just about a 2+2. So you can get the teenager horizontally in the back.
Mine will always be the submarine car from The Spy Who Loved Me. That just dates my age. If people want to find out more information about you or about the book, I know that you do the social media thing and you have an excellent website. Where can they find you, Johnny?
Well, thank you for that. My website is www.johnnytipler.co.uk.
And we can also find you on the Instagram as well. This book is called Lotus, the Complete Story. It's by Johnny Tipler, who we've been speaking to today. It's to be available as well as a virtual download from our virtual bookstore as well. Only begs the question, you've done this sort of thing before, Johnny. So you've done like 30, 40, 50 books by now. So what are you up to next?
I'm doing a biography of Mike Kimberly, who was the Lotus CEO, who, as I said earlier on, he wrote the foreword to this particular book that we're now discussing. But when I was talking to him about doing the foreword, I thought to myself, this chap, there needs to be a book about him. And straight away, a publisher called The Porter Press said, yep, we'll take that. And I'm working with Mike Kimberly on his biography.
Well, we look forward to that one. But this book is called Lotus, the Complete Story. It's by Johnny Tipler, who's speaking to you today. Johnny, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been fantastic chatting away. And I hope we can chat some more about your history in motor racing as well.
Look forward to it.